This is Bill Tiller of Tiller.org. You're listening to BBSRadio.com. Don't forget to tune in to The Infinite Consciousness with Eva Herr every Sunday at 7 p.m. Pacific Time. Enjoy.
Welcome to The Infinite Consciousness this week, and thanks for listening. This is Eva Herr, and tonight I have with us Dr. Pamela Heath. We had Dr. John Klimo on a few months ago and talked about consciousness, suicide, and what happens in the afterlife. And the two of them wrote a really good book, Suicide, What Really Happens in the Afterlife. So now we're going to have the other half. Thanks for being with us, Dr. Heath.
Thank you for having me.
Really interesting book, I have to say. Tell us a little bit about you so they know who you are and the background you come from in writing this book.
Okay, I'm actually a physician, originally trained as an anesthesiologist, and I started having psychic experiences about, 15, 20 years ago on my own, and didn't quite understand what it was about or why I could do things science said were impossible, and I spent a couple years actually working on the Navajo Indian Reservation while I was trying to sort things out, and then I discovered that there was actually a school where I could study parapsychology in the United States, which I'm sorry to say no longer exists. But I did, before it closed, get a doctorate degree in parapsychology, my specialties being...
Where was that?
It was Rosebridge Graduate School of Integrative Studies.
Interesting.
And John Klimo was the head of the program, which is how he and I originally met. And I often heard him talk about this topic of the channeled messages of suicides, because he'd been asked once to get together some of the channeled information on it, channeling, of course, being information which comes through mediums. We think through ESP from sources outside the medium, whether it be spirits in the afterlife or otherworldly beings, other dimensional beings.
And so I have to ask you here, how did your peers take that work?
I do not often talk with my peers about parapsychology. However, I do mention it occasionally. In California, of course, it's better accepted than in other parts of the country it might be. But I would have to say I'm cautious in who I speak to and how much I talk about it.
Yeah, it's kind of that way all across the board with everybody I interview. Bill Tiller told me one time that his peers wish that he would go away.
Well, I don't think it's quite so bad in anesthesia, because we're used to dealing with altered states of consciousness all the time. That's our job, is to alter people's states of consciousness. And when you start talking about psychic information, much of it does come in altered states.
I guess you get to see a lot of... near-death experiences being in the OR like that, handling
No, I'm
the drugs.
I'm happy to say that most of my patients do very well, so I don't have personal exposure to too many. But near-death experiences certainly were a part of our book. When we wanted to look at suicide, it's a subjective, in some ways, we're talking about an experience in the afterlife, what their experience was like. And so you're talking about something that's potentially subjective. And so just like if you were a policeman trying to find out what happened at the scene of a crime, where you try to get as many different streams of information to corroborate, we kind of did the same thing, only what we used was a variety of different sources. We didn't just look at information that was written in books by psychic mediums. We also looked at near-death experiences, reincarnation research, ordinary people's dreams, past life hypnotherapy regression, and psychomantium experiences. So we try to get a broad range of experiences.
And you did it from religious traditions across the board, right?
We did our best. We tried to get from as many different eras and as many different cultures the information so that we could try and boil it down to where we could find common ground so that, you know, whether it was in the 17th century or last month, you know, last year, where did the mediums say the same things were happening? However, I will say that while we were able to get a few Hindu and Buddhist and, of course, Christian channels, we were not able to get any Muslim channels. And that's because Islam has a very different relationship with the paranormal. They're not big on it.
Mm-hmm. And what happens when you commit suicide? What was the general consensus?
Well, what seems to happen is the same thing as happens for everybody else. They go through the same basic stages, and that there are spirits waiting to greet them on the other side. Often, spirits who have themselves passed over through suicide, so they know what these people are going through. They will have a chance to go to their funerals if they want to. They will go through a phase where they do a life review and self-judgment. They usually have an opportunity to do spiritual work. And if you believe in reincarnation, and a number of sources suggest you then have a chance to reincarnate and face the same things you tried to escape from again, only this time solve them in a different way. The difference is that these stages seem to be more difficult for suicide souls to get through than for souls that have passed through other means.
Is it because they cross over in pain and without the body to slow the frequency down, they feel it with greater intensity and can't get out of it?
Some of the, well, there's a couple different issues involved, Eva. Part of it is the fact that it's a sudden death. So you'll see a certain amount of the same kind of problems in people who die by accidents or trauma. But some of it also appears to be due to the state of mind that you're in when you cross over. And Buddhists like to talk about this, that your emotional state when you cross can have an impact on how smooth that transition is. And if you're extremely depressed, you carry that depression over with you. And you have to understand that in the afterlife, of course, you don't have a physical body. So you don't have eyes. You don't have ears. What you hear and see, so to speak, or perceive, is limited by what you're willing to perceive. And people who are really depressed tend to be very closed off from seeing the spirit helpers around them. There seems to be a lot of problem for them to realize that there are greeters waiting for them to try to help them make this transition.
What if you were, let's say someone was highly spiritually evolved and they believed totally in non-duality, and they were just tired of being here? Because I've heard many people on an accelerated path say that they're just tired of being here. What if somebody like that did it when they crossed over? Because they were with peace with it and just tired, would it be the same? Does that make sense?
I think they might have a smoother transition, but I think they would probably still have regrets when they got over to the other side. The only group of suicides that didn't have regrets were people who were end of life with terminal illness. Those who were cutting their life short by maybe a few days, you know, a short period of time, they were already dying. And this was a case of assisted suicide or euthanasia. Those people seem to have very different experiences from traditional suicides or suicide mass murderers. The people with assisted suicide tend to have very smooth transition, very few regrets. But everybody else who got over to the other side seemed to have regrets. And the regrets would vary. Sometimes they regretted who found their body. Sometimes they realized there were things they were meant to do that they cut short. You know, that they didn't realize when they were alive that they had planned to accomplish a bunch of things. And they cut it short, and they realized that that was a mistake.
That's amazing. So how did they feel about the people around them that they lived with?
Okay, again, I'm talking generalities here. Because this book is over 400 pages long, and
I know it's very, very thick.
It's simplistic, but one of the problems is that when you cross over, you're still connected to the living through bonds of love. and they're still very aware of what people are thinking about them and saying about them. And they have to deal with that. And a lot of times when someone crosses over through suicide, it causes a tremendous amount of trauma to those left behind. They're devastated. They're angry. They're guilty. They say, you know, why didn't I see it? Why didn't I stop it? And the person who successfully committed suicide is aware of that. They're feeling that guilt and that anger and that other mix of emotions, and it adds in some ways to their trauma and to their burden of what they have to deal with and what they have to look at.
What about suicide bombers? What, have you had any experience with information about that?
We wanted to look at suicide bombers, and we put a lot of effort into trying to find out information on that. What was sort of interesting, and perhaps not surprising, is there is very little written on suicide murder or suicide mass murder in the general channeled literature. And I went through about 500 books or so, and only a quarter of them even had information on suicide at all. So what John and I ended up doing is we ended up going to a number of psychic mediums and asking them if they would try to channel suicide bombers so that we could sort of interview these spirits, shall we say, through the medium. Mm-hmm. And most mediums said no, because they didn't want to deal with these folks. So what we ended up settling on was trying to interview their spirit guides. There are certain spirit guides who specialize in dealing with suicide bombers, as well as those who specialize in dealing with just plain suicide.
Mm-hmm.
And then usually what happened is once the medium started to get comfortable with the spirit guides, then the spirits themselves came through a little bit more. Now, we did have several spirits that who claimed to have been suicide bombers who came through. And you'll notice my hesitation, my voice, because you never know when you're dealing with channeled material whether the spirits you're talking to are who they claim to be.
Mm-hmm.
But there was a lot of interesting information in there. I think perhaps some of it was actually surprisingly optimistic in the sense that they were saying there's a lot of disagreement over in the Middle East about doing suicide attacks that we're not aware of. A lot of families are very upset with those who go off to commit mass murder this way. They don't agree with it. It's not the unified front we might think it is. They also were very optimistic. They thought that there's a lot of changes going on in the world that could let us see an end to terrorism in our lifetime.
That would be amazing.
It would be, and I actually found that very surprising, but more than one medium said that. It came from different sources, which I tend to put a little more weight into it when I hear something from different sources. When you hear it from just one source, you sort of wonder, but...
We could probably go off on a whole hour-long interview about that, too.
The most interesting part of the book. That's the part I reread the most. It's got some very interesting general material. But I think for most people, the traditional suicide information is probably more of general use, especially the parts of how you can help them.
Yes, that was my next question. What can you do to help them?
Prayer seems to work. You know, and it doesn't matter what your religion is or even whether you consider yourself particularly spiritual. If you're sending good wishes and prayer and hope that they do well and move forward, and that they're okay, and you send them your love, they receive that, and that helps them. And they will send us messages back, too, that they still love us. That bond of love doesn't end just because they cross over.
When they first cross over, is really the only thing that happens is a physical body drop away?
It depends. That's the main thing. You know, some spirits said it was painless. Some described some pain with the transition. But there's not always pain. And, in fact, one of the problems that we saw a lot of is that many spirits who commit suicide won't realize they succeeded. and they'll keep trying to kill themselves, even
really?
Though they're already dead. Yeah. In fact, because they're unaware of their spirit helpers, it may take the living mediums, psychic mediums, to be able to reach these folks and explain to them what's going on and that they need to, you know, look for their spirit helpers and move to the light.
Do you, I doubt you've probably had this experience because I doubt it would happen, but have you been able to talk to somebody that passed on that was a believer in non-duality? Do they go through the same kind of steps or do they do what they think they do in mind, you know, when they're living here? And just absorb back into the one.
I haven't talked to anybody in that situation. Yeah. From what I read of what other mediums wrote, there do seem to be some differences in speed and transition to what level, you know, how close you return to the source.
Can you,
you know, if you're
describe
talking about
that?
A spirit like Mother Teresa? She's going to sort of zoom forward, you know, a lot faster than the rest of us.
How does that occur? How do they describe it? Or how does it happen on
you know,
the other
different,
side?
Different mediums describe different numbers of levels in the afterlife, mm-hmm. with different levels being different vibrational, energetic levels, with the higher vibrations being closer and closer to the source.
And were they just experience in mind, or is there some type? I guess the non-duality.
Well, there is only
here.
Mind. There is only mind. If you're talking about in the afterlife, there's only consciousness anyway. So that's the only way
but
there
do
is.
Do they imagine themselves to go into some kind of beat, like heaven with angels and harps and things, or do they feel themselves
ah.
and just.
Well, there is a certain amount of self-fulfilling
energy.
Prophecy. And this gets back to what I said about how people don't have eyes or ears, so they perceive what they expect to perceive, and they'll block out what they don't believe to be true. And some of the spirit guides would talk about how they'd have to do play acting, and they might pretend to be angels with harps, and somebody pretend to be Gabriel and blow a horn and
right.
stuff.
Right, okay.
If people insist that that's what they're going to have to see or they aren't going to believe they're dead, the spirit realm is more than happy to provide that. From what I could tell, though, none of us have it quite right. When you talk about the afterlife, you know, none of us is 100% accurate in terms of our expectations. So to a certain extent, we're all going to have a little bit of adjustment phase when we make our transitions.
How long does it usually take?
If you could factor in time. Yeah, it moves totally different there. If you're talking about doing the life review and self-judgment, which is an important part of, shall we say, adjusting to the afterlife before you choose your spiritual work and whether you go into another lifetime or not. There were people who talked about almost immediately reincarnating, and there were others who talked about having to do that life review for thousands of years.
Mm-hmm.
You know, particularly if they had done great evil. You know, harmed a lot of others.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say, you not only have to do your own life review, but you have to look at the life of every person whose life you cut short. If you killed other people, you have to look at everything that would have happened had they lived, every life they would have touched had they lived.
And I would imagine that they would experience those emotions as well.
Yes, yes. And you don't necessarily do a life review just once. There are spirit guides to help you do this, both so that you aren't too harsh on yourself and to make sure that you aren't too easy on yourself and miss out on some important learning. So you may have to go through your life review many, many times before you fully get all the knowledge and wisdom and understanding out of it that you can and before you're allowed to move on.
So I guess that's why it's good to have unconditional love for one another. You know, Danielle Brinkley says, I hug everybody I see because I know because I've been there. If I'm hugging them, I'm hugging me.
Uh-huh, there's truth to that.
So I guess it would make a difference. So when you cross over, do they say that pain that they feel from observing what they did to others is very much more intense than we have it here?
Yes. Yeah, they do. And that's why one of the things they recommend that's very hard to do, I think, for people, is that if you've had someone that you know who crossed over from suicide, to let go of any of your own guilt or grief or anger and let them go with love. And that's very hard to do sometimes, but that's the most helpful to them because they feel that anger much more intensely even than you do.
What kind of messages did you have for the people that they left behind?
Oh, the commonest one is that they're still loved. They want people to know they're okay, that they still love them. They often would say that suicide is not a solution. Very common message, because it's not uncommon for other family members to start to feel down and to wonder if, you know, they should commit suicide too, and they don't want other family members to follow in their footsteps.
Do they ever come back and give family members advice from about things
yeah.
that are happening in the future?
Yeah, there were a few cases. There was a case of at least one warning where they saw something that could be bad happening that they suggested, you know, made some advice to the family. So they will occasionally come back to let people know that. But the commonest message by far is just to let people know that they're still loved. And they'll sometimes also ask for forgiveness.
Yeah, I can imagine that.
Yeah.
You know, don't you think that it probably takes an hour time? A lot of the people that I've at least interviewed or talked to, at least 2 to, say, 4 or 5 years, if they've crossed over, sometimes before they can get into a better space, years in our time?
It can be. But it really varied a lot by the suicide. There were some suicides who seemed to make, you know, relatively quick transitions, especially if they were able to see their spirit helpers. There were other suicides who literally, you know, they claimed it might be hundreds or thousands of years.
Interesting. Do you think that, let's talk about reincarnation just for a minute.
Sure.
You know, in quantum mechanics, they say that there is no past or no future because there's no time, but there's different frequencies which make up different parallel universes. Do you think that there is a past and a future, or do you think that everything is happening right now and we perceive it to be at a different time, perhaps in mind, when they come back to talk?
My personal belief is that all things unfold simultaneously, you know, in a multidimensional way. But I also think the human mind is not capable of dealing with that. Or being able to, time is a very useful construct, and it also allows us to learn things that are not capable of being learned in the spirit realm, which is to say we can learn about boundaries, because if you think about it, time is one of the most fundamental boundaries we deal with.
Yeah.
It marks beginnings and endings. And in the spirit realm, there really are no boundaries. And so there's no way to learn lessons that involve boundaries, us, them, you know,
right.
sharing, because everything is us. Everything is me. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So that makes the physical dimension a very useful one for learning certain lessons. And I think it makes time a useful construct, not only in terms of helping us understand and organize our thinking, but also in terms of as a way of understanding lessons and boundaries.
Did they ever talk about how they merged back with oneness, how that happens?
We didn't really get into that. We were focused on, like I say, the spirit realm. There is some talk in the last third of the book, which I have to refer to as being as kind of Zen-like, and that the more you read a Zen story, the more you get out of it. And there are some messages from spirit guides, very advanced beings, from what I could tell, that every time I read it, it just sort of like boggles me. They talk about concepts that I still don't think I'm fully understanding about lineage in terms of our lineage of existence and things, in terms of unfoldment, which is how the spirit gradually opens up like a tightly furled fern bud, you know, how it will open up.
Mm-hmm.
And that's sort of what spiritual unfolding is. It's just, they have some interesting concepts.
Do they have any suggestions to the people who are suicidal now about how to not be there?
Absolutely. First of all, they say there's always help there. You don't realize it, but there is. You just have to ask for it. You just have to open up to it. They also say listen to the thoughts in the quiet moments. That a lot of us are very, very busy in our thinking, and we're especially when you're suicidal, you may be constantly thinking negative thoughts like, oh, I'm so bad, oh, it's never going to get better, or whatever. To just sort of stop in all that thinking for a moment and give the spirit realm a chance to insert a word in edgewise, you know, in our minds.
Mm-hmm.
Let them give us our thoughts, some thoughts, some ideas. But they're in the quiet little moments. It's a quiet little voice. Those of us who have psychic abilities are kind of used to this, because this is how a lot of psychic information comes. And that's also why I think meditation is helpful for many people, is it learns to quiet that constant chatter that goes on in your mind,
mm-hmm,
which
mm-hmm.
gives the spirits a chance to talk to you.
Yeah, you can't hear someone else if you're talking yourself.
Mm-hmm.
Or thinking, in this case, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So did you find any differences between children and adults?
I think with the children, it's much harder for those left behind to let go of them. And that,
I
in turn,
can imagine.
Has, well, it, and you can, can't you? It'd be very hard to let go of a child. And a lot of parents will create shrines to their children and things like that. And it's actually is not helpful. It actually holds their children back and keeps them from being able to finish making their transition. They will sometimes,
like magnetism, it keeps them stuck, I guess.
Exactly, and they'll sometimes, and this, by the way, is not just with suicides. It's with, it's something that I saw in the channel literature with all children who died young, whether through illness or accident. It didn't matter. It's very, very hard for the parents, and my heart goes out for them. It's just so hard to deal with this. And yet, they're telling us that what we can do to best help those children is to pray for them and to let them go with love.
Well, Kim, you tell us a little bit about, I'm sure you at least know some interesting stories about near-death experiences. I can't help but ask about that. So interesting.
I actually, you know, most of these stories came from the books. I actually only know a few people with near-death experiences. What I would say is that they can run the gamut from positive to negative. And the suicide near-death experiences, I don't think were any different, really, from other near-death experiences. In other words, some of them were positive, some of them were negative. Some of them were aware of meeting somebody and being told to go back. I would say the one thing that a lot of people don't seem to be aware about with near-death experiences is that they do vary by culture. In other words,
really?
In our culture, everybody talks about the tunnel and the white light and that kind of thing. But if you were in Japan, they cross a bridge to an island where their ancestors are waiting for them.
I've never thought about that. That's an interesting thing.
So there do seem to be some cultural variations, which kind of cuts some of the underpinnings out of the people who argue that the tunnel of white light is just losing
some
blood
kind of firing
and being hypotensive.
Yeah,
and all that stuff. And there's just And I'm like, you know, I can't buy it, because then why do you see different types of near-death experiences that have nothing to do with the tunnel or white light in other cultures?
You know, I guess they just fire in that order, in the shape of a bridge or something.
Right. Only if you're Japanese. I'm sorry.
Right.
You know, I think there's more to it than simply the brain dying.
I do, too. Well, speaking about dying and death and the afterlife, what do you believe to be, this has nothing to do with your book, but I have to ask this, the level of conscious awareness that it's okay to turn somebody off? Do you think, knowing what you know, like that, you know, if somebody's in a coma, but their
mm-hmm.
bodily organs are good,
yeah,
can they, and they've been in a coma 6 months, or is it likely that they, can they come back?
Well, actually, that is talked about in our book, because we talk about that in terms of assisted suicide, turning off life support.
Oh, okay, I guess I missed that.
And, well, it's not a big section, because there's not a lot of people who talked about it that we can pull information from. But it appears that there is no spiritual harm to either the person whose life support is terminated or to the person who terminates the life support. In other words, the person who assists in that by saying, you know, my sense is this person is dead, they aren't coming back,
mm-hmm.
They will not be considered a murderer in the afterlife. And
good.
In fact, there are some souls who apparently chose before they incarnated to be in that situation where one would be brain dead on life support, and the other's job was to turn it off.
Well, you know,
this is something they agreed upon in advance.
I had something really interesting happen that relates to that. I went to the gas station one night, and you know, I have a psychic ability, and this woman in the gas station knew that I had it, and she'd been begging me to read for it.
Mm-hmm.
I wouldn't do it because I didn't want to be in the store and do that. Well, one night about 10 o'clock, I went up there to get a Coke, and she followed me out to my car and got in and said, read for me.
Uh-huh.
So I said, "What?" The first thing I heard was tell her that she had a pregnancy gone bad and that I'm the baby and that it's okay.
Yeah.
That's the reason I chose her. So I said, "Did you have a pregnancy?" And she said, "Yeah, I had an abortion about 2 months ago."
Yeah.
So from that moment on, I believed that statement.
Yeah,
that they choose.
Yeah, I think they sometimes do. Certainly, in terms of assisted suicide, I'd like to reassure people it's considered quite different. In fact, I have to say, as a doc, I was kind of surprised at how differently it's treated and how different their experiences are from all other forms of suicide. However, even some of them had regrets about doing it. Some of them had agreements that, you know, they were very ill and that somebody was going to be taking care of them, sometimes as sort of a past life debt that needed to be paid back, sometimes
mm-hmm.
as learning, and that they were going to learn how to receive, the other person was going to learn how to give, and they cut it short. And they looked back and they said, you know, I shouldn't have done that. That wasn't in my benefit or theirs. So they suggest that if you're in that situation, that you make a very mindful choice and that you talk about other people with other people around you and you make sure everybody's in full agreement before you proceed. But they say if this is something you've given a lot of thought to, if you are end of life, and they do emphasize that, not just have a serious illness, but if you are end of life and you've talked about it with everybody, everybody's in full agreement, everybody's okay with this, you know, you don't feel that there's any more that can be gleaned from this experience, then they say, yes, it's certainly okay to proceed at that point. But
that's
they say
good to know.
It needs to be a very thoughtful choice, and they make it quite clear, because I've had a lot of people call me up and write me about this and say, oh, I have a serious illness, you know, I want to do this. And I'm like, you know, they tell us that's not the same situation.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that if you have a major medical illness but it's not terminal, well, there's, you know, there's something to be learned from that, to be gained from that. Don't cut that short.
Right.
Nobody wants to hear that. And I have to say, I don't blame them. I wouldn't want to hear it either in their shoes. But, hey, don't kill the messenger. I'm just, you know, just the person who did the literature review.
You have a couple of other interests that are quite interesting to me. Mind over matter. We've got about 15 minutes.
Okay.
Can you talk a little bit about that? You tell me some interesting things today.
Yeah. My other book is called The PK Zone. It's a cross-cultural review of psychokinesis. And it talks about mind over matter. And the first third of the book is different stories of mind over matter experiences from around the world since the dawn of time. And it looks at all different cultures. And the middle third talks about the experimental research. And the last third of the book talks about what the experience is like for those people who do it. And sort of gives some clues on how you might be able to get it better under control if you do it, or how you might learn how to be able to do it if you want to know how.
So why don't you tell people, what is the it? I mean, you told me, you because they may not really know what you're talking about yet.
In terms of mind over matter?
You mentioned about turning off lights or messing up computers.
Well, yeah, I think the word we see it most often nowadays is in computers that die when someone walks by them, you know, or a computer suddenly goes wacky and haywire and starts doing things that are impossible for it to do, which I got to say, tech support is very clued into this, because a lot of times they'll say, are you in a bad mood? And you'll go, yes, this, you know, stupid computer, I'm ready to drop ticket, you know.
Right.
And they'll say, step away from the computer for half an hour.
Really?
Calm down. Seriously.
That's amazing.
Or other people, you might have metal bending, whether it be spoon bending, or I have a friend whose keys will spontaneously bend in his hand.
No way.
If he's frantic, yeah. But he does other kinds of PK too. But firewalking is a pretty famous one. A lot of people who talk about learning how to focus, inspirational talkers, will use firewalking. Firewalking is mind over matter. Anomalous healing.
Strong.
Anomalous healing is another way of another form of mind over matter that you may hear about, psychic healing.
Is that what John of God does? Is that how he does it?
Who?
Have you heard of John of God? He's that South American healer that can put his hands inside people and pull out tumors or cut on them with a knife and
yeah, if you're talking about psychic surgery, that's considered mind over matter. However, I would caution people, there seem to be some very different groups of psychic surgeons. For the Brazilian people, most of them, or some of them, I should say, do appear to be quite legit. Most of the ones I've read about in the Philippines do not seem to be. There seems to be more chicanery involved than true psychic healing. But another group, by the way, is the dervishes, in terms of something called deliberately caused bodily damage. This was also done by Native American Indians with the Sundance, where you deliberately, you know, stab yourself with skewers and things. And it's sort of interesting because we don't really know whether it's paranormal healing or actually paranormal wounding, that it's done in such a way that the wound disappears within a minute or two of the skewer being taken. Yeah, it's an interesting phenomenon. And that's one of the few things that actually is reported a lot in Islam, one of the few accepted paranormal feats.
So they do that a lot over there? I didn't know they did anything like that.
It seems to be pretty common. There's a number of groups in Iran and Iraq. It's called deliberately caused bodily damage. And Hamal Hussein is a parapsychologist over in Jordan who's done a lot of the research on that group. And I'm actually working on rewriting the PK Zone to update it. And there's going to be a much bigger chapter in the next book on it.
How do people feel after they do something like this?
He says he has no pain. I mean, he, in fact, most of those people they have no pain, but they will do this, of course, in a trance state, and they view this as a way of sort of proving or demonstrating, that's a better word, of demonstrating God's powers.
So I guess they must have a very cohesive, focused intention to do that, I would imagine.
Yeah, but again, the question is it really the person who's being wounded who's doing it or the person who's doing the wounding? It could be that the person who's really doing what's paranormal is the guy who's doing the wounding, not the one who's being skewered.
Oh, I see, yeah.
Yeah,
it's
an interesting...
I was thinking that we were talking about doing it to themselves. I don't know why I thought that.
Oh, that can be done. There have been some... there was actually an experiment that was reported in... I'd have to pull the journal. It might be Advances in Mind-Body Medicine. That involved Hamal Hussein, who is himself a dervish, who in, I think, a X-ray facility in Ohio actually skewered himself, and they documented everything with X-rays and everything. And
really?
Very interesting. Yeah, very interesting stuff.
So why does he say that he did that? Or does he?
Well, I haven't. He and I have not spoken specifically about that, but he certainly does believe in the paranormal. And
is he doing something? Is he doing like an honor to God, or is he killing a demon when he does that?
Oh, he's not killing a demon at all, no.
Okay.
No.
So he's not killing a... Is he
no,
doing,
he's just demonstrating this ability,
okay.
I think, so that we can study it here in the West. But he's also a dervish, so he is a devout person on his own.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Wow. That's just amazing. And people that bend spoons, can they... A lot of people have told me that they have to get in a group, but you don't have to have a group energy to do that, do you? Can't an individual do that?
Not at all. No, absolutely it can be done as an individual. And what I found was when you looked at mind over matter experiences, they boiled down to certain things tended to be happening every time. For example, there was almost always an altered state of consciousness, especially if people were very experienced and had this ability under their control. Whereas beginners, people who were doing it like a first time or who really didn't have it under their control at all, they were usually in a very high emotional state, like when you're really frustrated at your computer, you know? Or
Some
people can kill their cars the same way. If they're too excited, it's like they kill their car. I blow light bulbs. If I'm angry... light bulbs go. You know, I can't touch a switch or that bulb is out. It's history. I've killed three in a row before I stopped sometimes.
I've had that happen. Maybe, I mean, light bulbs blown. I never thought about doing it myself. Maybe that's what I did.
It's a possibility.
Four or five in my house at one time.
So that's peak emotion states, and that's also something you see with, for example, poltergeist phenomena, which people, most parapsychologists feel is usually human PK, human mind over matter.
Mm-hmm.
They're usually got a lot of emotion stuff. There's usually, with PK, there's a sense of connection to something outside of yourself, quite often something greater than yourself. So you'll see a lot of things happen, for example, in devout prayer, where not only are you in the altered state of consciousness that can be involved in prayer, but you're also feeling one with God.
Yes, yeah.
Okay. There's a suspension of rational thinking. There's an intense focus. And that intense focus I saw in every single example of mind over matter experience. No matter spontaneous, intentional, whatever, there was always some kind of intense focus. And if you're talking about the people who are doing firewalking, they're often told to focus on imagery of cool moss. And they sort of focus on that term, cool moss, cool moss. Things like that.
Interesting.
But
how long does it take
focus.
Somebody to perfect something like that?
I think, to be honest, it varies. I think if you talk about any kind of psychic abilities, it's a need-based thing. In other words, when you look at what somebody's capable of doing, or it really doesn't tell you so much about what their limits are as to what is important to their unconscious mind. So it's going to vary depending on how much do you really need to do this, and also I think how old your soul is, how much practice or experience, how advanced it is.
Would it matter how much time you spent devoted to it, practicing on it?
Again, I would say it depends, but certainly meditation and things like that I think are helpful in developing.
Mm-hmm. I found with my gift, the more time I spent learning to discern, the quicker that it came, it seems like anyway.
Yeah, as long as you also work on your stuff, because you have to understand that all psychic information and everything that happens psychically really seems to come through the unconscious mind.
Mm-hmm.
So the unconscious mind is going to act as a filter. It can also act as a blocker. And you may have to deal with your stuff. You know,
right.
I think most people who are psychic, if you look at your issues, if you deal with your stuff, you will get much farther faster than if you want to not look at your stuff.
Right, right. Well, we got just a minute or two left. I'd like for, if you don't mind, tell people where they can find your website, the name of your books, so they can Google them perhaps, how to contact you.
Well, the best way to contact me is through my website, which is www.pamelaheath.com. And, of course, you can
spell
also
that
find
it, so they can make sure they understand
okay.
that one.
Okay, PamelaHeath.com. Or you can also go to my co-author's website, which is www.jonklimo.com. The names of my books are The PK Zone and Suicide, What Really Happens in the Afterlife.
And it really goes into a lot more stuff than we could even cover tonight, but I at least wanted to touch on the thing that Ms. Minnie said.
Yeah, and before people get angry, I want them to understand this is very complex information. I've presented it in a very simplified format, but it's very complex. And we did look at everything we could find. Some of this information goes back to the 1700s. Some of it is modern day from people like John Edward and James von Prague.
Mm-hmm.
And what we looked for was we tried to find common ground. Where did everybody say the same things? And we also pointed out where they said different things so that the reader could make up their own mind as to what might be most likely to be true.
Right. You did a good job. It's a great book. I loved it.
Well,
thank you for being with me, Pam. I've really enjoyed having both you and John, and I hope you'll come back sometime, especially
anytime.
When you get your book updated.
Oh, yeah. It was my pleasure.
Thanks, and agape to you. Good night.
All right. Bye-bye.